Hello, my loves. I know I told you I was going on summer vacation, and don't worry, I am. But I'm here re-releasing for you the top 10 old money episodes from the first 100 that we've created together. And what a journey it's been. What a journey it's been. So, first of all, this episode's really fun. I got a lot of fodder, a lot of DMs on this one. And it's very appropriate time-wise because it is exploring European versus American old money and what the differences are there. And we go into it. I got a little controversial on this one, but it's appropriate because I'm about to take off on a European vacation. So I can't wait to report back on all the old money that I see. But more importantly than that, it's a good reminder for me to tell you about my whole philosophy about taking a month off because it's so European to take a full month off for summer because there is a different mindset there. The thing about it is you can get away with it in Europe because everybody's doing it, right? Like the offices are closed for all intents and purposes. So it's not like you're taking a month off and then missing out on everything. Just culturally, societally, everything kind of shuts down. So everybody rests. And we just don't have that culture in the US. In the US, it's like hustle when you're getting your kidneys out, hustle on Christmas morning, make sure you're sending invoices on the first of the year. How dare you have a hangover? But in Europe, when everybody agrees to a way of being, then it's kind of like, okay, we can all take some time off. So here's the thing. I forget a lot of what I talk about is stuff that we know, but we just forget. I forget and forgot that I was in charge of my life and my schedule, and I run my businesses the way that I want to run them. And it actually makes me a better leader, a better podcaster, a better partner when I rest and take breaks. Rest doesn't have to be earned. Rest is absolutely my right, and it's best for my nervous system to be replenished and recovered and restored so that I can come back with even more joie de vivre when the time is right. So my challenge to you, and I wrote this in a Instagram post, is to look at your own life and challenge some of the rules that you made up for yourself. Because I made up a rule for myself that I had to drop a podcast episode every week. Okay, that's a great rule. Like, I'm here for you guys. I love it. I love that we're doing this, but maybe I can drop two podcast episodes a week. Or maybe I could take a month off and go on vacation. Who knows what I feel like doing? It doesn't matter. I just decided to make new rules. And then also, if you are anything like me, like the end of the school year, the start of the summer, like there's nothing that feels more expansive and beautiful and like so much opportunity and so much fun. When is the last time you felt that way? How can we create that for ourselves? Like, what can we make new rules around? What can we do differently? What can we explore to create space? What are the things that we've said yes to that are obligations we don't want to do? What are the obligations we do want to do? What makes us feel expansive and young and fun? Go do more of that. So that's what I'm going to be doing. And in the meantime, I'll be dropping the top 10 of the first 100 episodes for you here and there. Back and forth, a little spotty. I'm gonna pop into your Instagram feed, I mean your podcast feed, whenever I feel like it and drop a little nugget of wisdom for you. I love you so much. I hope you have an expansive summer ahead of you, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Let me know what you think. I'll be on Instagram, social media, send me DMs. Let me know what you want to hear when I come back, when I start recreating, or not recreating, but creating again. Love you guys, and I'll talk to you soon. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to Old Money, a show dedicated to helping you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. Ladies who lunch, listen up. Life is not about looking rich. I want you to build a life and a legacy that feels rich in every sense of the word. If you're ready to stack cash, talk shop, and trade insider secrets, you're in the right place. These are the new rules to Old Money, so let's get after it. Hello, rich girls. Welcome back to Old Money, the podcast for women building the trust funds they wish they were born with. I'm your host, Amber Frankhusen. Happy summer. I hope you are having such an expansive, wealthy, beautiful, sun-filled, relaxing season, because that's what this is all about. If you remember, Carol Razzedwell so eloquently put that she only had, I think she said, 5 good summers left. We have to remember we only have so many summers, you guys. I think this is very pertinent for people with kids. When you think about you only have 18 summers with your children while they're at home, sorry to bum you out if that bums you out. However, it's a good reminder to lean into the season that we're in. And part of the season of summer, traditionally, as we've grown up, it's time off, right? And as you know, we just got back from an incredible trip to Europe. And from that trip, I had been thinking so much and could not wait to talk to you all about this, which is the difference between US and European old money and what we can learn from the Europeans to enhance our rich lives today. Because if you've ever been to Europe, especially in the summer, you know that they move different. They do things differently there. For example, if you live in France, it is completely customary to take the entire month of August off because everybody else does. It's like a cultural thing. You're good, right? Same thing in Spain. You're going to have a siesta in the afternoon. You're going to have shops closed on most Sundays because people use that as a day of rest. There's a lot more emphasis on family, connection, mealtime, speed of things, or rather lack thereof. And so I dug in over the last couple of weeks, also after observing just life in Europe and what that really means, but more importantly, digging into the wealthy and the wealth history of European. So I want to talk today about what it means to be European old money from my perspective. Again, what we can learn from it too, and what the differences are. And I think the big difference is pretty obvious. European old money is old. It's so much older. We're talking about nobility titles. We're talking about the Renaissance. We're talking about basically the birth of civilization, whereas the US was founded in 1776. Like, we're still a baby country. So when we talk about generational wealth in the United States, how many generations are we talking about? Sometimes three, four, five. We're talking about generational wealth in Europe, you can go back hundreds and hundreds of years. Of course, when we talk about US old money, so to speak, I mean, granted, using common sense, even if you had the opportunity to fly over here on the Mayflower, and by fly, I mean boat, you know what I mean? You show up as a European American, a founder of this country, and of course, our native people were here, and they got wiped out by disease and murder and all that type of stuff, unfortunately. But if you are an early colonizer here and you have the opportunity to, I don't know, stake a claim to a piece of land that maybe you didn't even have to buy, you just had to steal it 300, 200, 100 years ago. I mean, my goodness, think about property values in San Diego County over the past 5 years. They've gone up exponentially. Just by holding onto that land over time, your wealth is going to increase because the value is going to increase. When we think about the infrastructure of what started our country, we think about the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, we think about the railroads and steel. And as you know, I believe very strongly that everything in life always comes back to Bravo. And when we think about some of the old money families, we actually have them on our television screens today. If you watch Southern Charm, you're very familiar with Shep Rose. I call Southern Charm Bopadoo, by the way. I've never called it Southern Charm before in my life. When it's on, I tell Justin, like, I'm going to watch Bopadoo because you know that's the best theme song that is ever theme songed. But I digress. Shep Rose, who is the king of mailbox money, I think even in the, not the last reunion, but the one prior, he was accused of getting mailbox money from Taylor when they were breaking up or whatever. And he denied it. But we all know he comes from a trust. His family is steeped in history. So according to the internet, Shep is related to the Boykin family. If you've ever heard of a Boykin Spaniel, it's the South Carolina state dog. And it was named through his father, whose family founded the town of Boykin, South Carolina in 1755. So that's what I'm talking about. Stake and claim, being the ones to set it up. And then you're involved in everything and your wealth just grows and grows over time, right? And through his mom's side is actually a family connected to the railroads that came out of Chicago during the 1800s. So think about this. If I have a marketing agency that I founded in 2018 and I had it in my family for 200 years, just think about the establishment that that would be. You know what I mean? So he has these just deep roots in American history from, you know, the history of all these successful professionals in the steel industry or in the legal industry. And not only that, it's rumored that him and his family have been members of some of the most exclusive private members clubs in the nation, like dating back to when our country was founded. Again, think about the networking opportunities or the people you're going to do business with when you have access to those types of groups. One of them is the St. Cecilia Society in Charleston. It's like as exclusive as it gets. And they started tracking membership back around Civil War times. And membership is only passed down through generations on the male side. We hate it, but it's one of those institutions. And that's like a musical institution. It's the first orchestra of Charleston, whatever. But essentially, Shep has had access to the riches of being an old money family, so much so that he can go on a reality TV show, get wasted, throw some of his money into different bars or hotels or whatever he's done without any real stakes attached, right? Because if it fails, so what? He just moves on to the next thing or continues to get his mailbox money. But I think he is such an interesting representation of what I think about when I think about American old money. It's a little sloppy. It's, you know, polos and shorts and boat shoes. It's just this attitude of aloofness and youth. And it's like he's perpetually living in an Abercrombie and Fitch catalog from 2005 with the floppy hair. There's just a real lack of refinement. And I'm not saying that's everybody in the US, but I do think that Shep Rose is a great caricature of what I think of when I think of US old money, especially on that East Coast. On the other hand, when you think about Europe, when you want to stay rich in Europe, all you're doing is inheriting money, but over 700 years. Can you imagine over 700 years your family has been building wealth? Again, going back to the US, so many of our listeners are first-generation Americans. If you came to this country or your parents brought you to this country and you have made it in the United States, it's an absolute incredible feat. If you have gone to school as a first generation in the US, it's an absolute incredible feat. Just to think about the advantage of time other families have had by being here longer or being there longer. And in comparison to somebody who's first or second generation, I'm second generation US. My mom was not born in this country. My father was from two immigrants that came to the US in the 50s. I mean, it's just crazy to think about the difference in opportunity you have when you have roots somewhere, you have a network somewhere, you have a business that's established in your family, and you're learning within, I don't know, like I think about it within the framework of that country, of that culture. I think about my mom who moved to the US from El Salvador, and she didn't speak the language. She didn't speak English when she moved here, and having to assimilate and figure out life as an 11-year-old in San Francisco in the 60s. That is crazy. And think about the difference if you're just from there and you understand the program and your parents speak the language and your parents have a good job and they help you get into a good school. It's just so different. So when we think about European old money, what's so crazy, and we were just in Florence, right? That was one of the parts of our Italy trip. And Florence was just run by, and honestly still is run by, the Medici's. Like, I used to think it was Medici, by the way. I don't know why I thought that, but Medici, I feel like, is the Italian pronunciation. Anyway, this family's been balling out since literally the 12th century. They came to Florence and they started a bank, and they were super wealthy, super connected. They were actually in power, really, truly, even over like the politicians in the area, because they were just the wealthiest. And they were also the bank of like the church, basically. And in addition to that, they were the trendsetters. They were the ones pushing the narrative for the Renaissance. They were the ones really responsible for funding so many of the artists that we know and we recognize with the Renaissance, like Leonardo da Vinci. You heard of our boy Leo. They were paying all of these artists. They were patrons of the art to create art around the church specifically. You know that da Vinci painted the Sistine Chapel. You know that he did one of the statues for the Medici tombs. Like, it's a whole thing, right? They are so and have been so influential that their family is actually depicted in a piece of work by Botticelli. And that's so major. It's such I can't even think of an analogy of what would matter more here in the US, except for maybe if they did a second Mount Rushmore and the faces were like Kathy and Rick and Paris and Nikki Hilton. That's literally what the level they were at. There are a ton of old money European families that have been influential and wealthy for centuries. And in fact, the reason that I think this story about the Medicis is so interesting is because there was a study done by a group of economists. And what they did is they studied in different areas the families who had tax records in like the 1400s, like 1427 was when they were looking at the tax records there. And then they compared that to the surnames of the families that are paying the most taxes now. And most of the family surnames are the same. Again, on that, how do you want to be rich in Europe? Just have a family that has lineage for 700 years. In a similar fashion, we talk about the British, right? Like the British are known to be aristocratic. We have the nobility. They did the same study. But what I love about this study is they looked at the Book of Flemish Conquerors of England in 1066 from records from estates in Normandy. And they looked at a Domesday Book of 1086, the nation's oldest surviving public record. And they pulled out some of the wealthiest last names from that. And listen to these last names. Baskerville, like the font. We know that's a font. Darcy, like Mr. Darcy. Jane Austen, she knew what was up. Montgomery. That makes me think of Addison Montgomery from Grey's Anatomy, who to me is one of the best characters in Private Practice. Did you guys watch that show? I was obsessed. Neville. Neville's just giving old money vibes for a first or a last name. And then the last names Percy and Talbot. And Talbot, that makes me think of, you know, middle-aged women's clothes, but you get the point. Those just sound like old money names. Because they are. For the last 1,000 years, those last names have been recorded in history as early conquerors and of being people worth a damn or worth a pound. Do you know what I mean? That's so crazy. And then they also were talking about, and this is a crazy stat by one of the economists, they say that social status is more strongly inherited even than height. That's coming out of UC Davis, okay? So like in London School of Economics, that's a quote from an economist. The correlation has been unchanged for centuries. I'm blown away by this. And they also talk a lot about attendance at Oxford or Cambridge also has a very strong correlation to success and wealth. I didn't even know this, but did you know that Oxford, like all British universities, they were free until 1986? That is crazy. So when we talk about Brits, we talk about old money British families. As I always tell you, listen to Auntie Amber. Everything comes back to Bravo because even when we're talking about one of the most influential, wealthy, and powerful families in London, we are actually talking about Kyle Richards and Kathy Hilton. And you cannot forget Kim, of course. But if you know the story about their mom, Big Kathy, Kathy Hilton, that's Paris and Nikki's mom. Their mom's name was Big Kathy. Kathy Hilton actually has a different dad than Kyle Richards and Kim Richards. So interesting. I didn't know that. But Big Kathy was known for her wildness. I never watched the Kyle Richards special. I think it was on USA or something random, American Woman. And Alicia Silverstone, who also played Cher Horowitz in Clueless, played the role of Big Kathy, Kyle's mom. Kyle, Kathy, and Kim's mom. So Big Kathy in this show, the reason it was such a divisive show and it caused all this rift between Kyle and Kathy was because Big Kathy actually has a terrible reputation. And there was once a book written about her, not an autobiography because it wasn't written by her. I guess it was a biography. And I think it actually got stopped in print because if you try to find this book, you can only buy it on like eBay and it's super expensive and it's not very complimentary, as I say, but it's definitely illuminating about how Big Kathy ran her life and how she raised her daughters. If you've seen Kim and Kyle Richards on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, you know that they were both child actors. And that was something that Big Kathy really pushed them into doing was show business. And according to this book, Big Kathy was also responsible for exposing her girls to adulthood
while they were really still children. And what I mean by that was there was a lot of pressure on Kim for her to be the breadwinner of the family. She was actually the bigger star as a child than Kyle Richards. And so she had a lot of financial pressures on her to perform. A lot of people attribute that type of pressure to some of the challenges she had with addiction later on in life. I cannot confirm or deny. I have no opinion on it. It's just what some people say. And also, Big Kathy was known for taking her girls to the clubs like Studio 54 and having them around drugs, drinking, alcohol. Think about like the Drew Barrymore story, how she was, you know, doing cocaine when she was 11, or I don't know, maybe she was drinking. I don't really know Drew Barrymore, except for she gets way too close to people on her talk show. I digress. Big Kathy was also, it was alleged that she would talk to her daughters a lot about the only thing that they need to do is to figure out how to have good sex with men to marry somebody rich. And she was solely focused on breeding her girls into women who would get married to very wealthy people. And there's a lot of conversation because Kathy Hilton was the oldest in the group that she took on a lot of that type of programming. And a lot of her focus was marrying very well. Now, Kyle Richards married very well in her first marriage. She got divorced. Farrah was the one daughter from that, I believe. Then she married Mauricio. And actually, when her and Mauricio got together, Mauricio was working for Kathy Hilton's husband and his family, Rick Hilton, in Hilton and Highland Real Estate Group. I'm really taking you back on the Bravo journey here, and I promise I'm coming back to European old money. My point was, Kathy Hilton did everything that Big Kathy wanted her to do. She married a very, very wealthy, very successful man, and it established her as a socialite, which to Big Kathy, there was no greater honor. Kim really struggled. Kyle got married to that other guy, then to Mauricio. But if you think about how these things get passed on through generations, Kathy Hilton embedded the same type of beliefs into Paris and Nikki, her daughters as well, which is crazy because Nikki Hilton, for the last 10 years, has been married to a member of the Rothschild family. She is now Nikki Hilton Rothschild, and the Rothschild family is one of the most powerful families in the world. They are originally from Germany, but they were also, similar to the Medicis, a very powerful banking dynasty in Europe, but later on, after the Medicis, in like the 19th century. And they established banking all across Europe. And they played such a huge role in all of these like government setups, infrastructure projects, all these different types of things. The 1760s is about when they really got started, but they just exploded and into other industries, including not just banking and financial services, but real estate, agriculture, mining, winemaking. And on the other side of James, that's the spouse of Nikki Hilton, on the other side of his family, his mother's side, she was a member of the Guinness family who founded the beer brand, obviously. So James Rothschild grew up in London. He worked at his family company, and then he moved into real estate investing. And about 10 years ago, he married Nikki Hilton. And now they live between London, New York. And I feel like Nikki's always at Kathy Hilton's house, like the party house. And by the way, I have tea on that. Kathy Hilton's house that they use for the show where they film, that's not where she lives. That house is for parties and for filming. That's not actually the house that she lives at. She has other homes in Los Angeles. I have a friend who went to a Christmas party there who's involved in TV and all that type of a world. And it's literally just a shell of a home. They use it for filming. I mean, it's all decorated and everything for Christmas and for filming and looking like she lives there, but she doesn't. Anyway, this all matters because when you think about Big Kathy, who was probably not the best role model, the best leadership, was focused on her daughter's statuses in relation to men, wasn't focused on education, was focused on money and power and status and society and being seen and being at the party and gluttony and drugs and alcohol and exposing her children to that as opposed to protecting them from it. When you look at what has happened with Nikki Hilton, she probably would be the apple of Big Kathy's eye of having married into one of the most powerful families in the world, cementing Big Kathy as the matriarch of that family. And we can really see that in Kathy Hilton too. Like, Nikki's just dialed, and so dialed that when her and James got married, they got married at Kensington Palace. That's correct, the very same place where Kate and Will live. Middleton, that is. And William, wait, what's William's last name? Not Middleton, that's Kate Middleton. I don't know, Prince William, soon to be king. A poor Charles, I don't know what's going on there. I hope Kate's okay. I know she's still going through cancer treatment, I believe. Ugh, so sad with her kids. Anyway, my point is getting married at Kensington Palace is no small feat. It's one of the most, I don't know, famous locations in the world, famous religious locations especially. But I was looking up, you know, I'm in wedding planning mode. Not that I would want to get married at Kensington Palace, but I'm just curious, like, what's the cost of the venue? And I found this article from E! That said that the cost of the venue was only $23,100 for a Saturday or Sunday. I cannot imagine that's accurate. I don't know if this article is from like 2011, but my God, there's no way, because it says for that price, you get a wedding planner, a taxi service, daytime cleaning, on-site security, and a private entrance for you and your guests to Kensington Palace. Or you can book what's called the Orangery, which is another wedding venue on-site. It's there, but it's like adjacent to the gardens. And you can book that for $15,800. That venue can accommodate like 150 guests for a ceremony or 300 for a reception. And it was originally built in 1704 for Queen Anne to use to house her collection of exotic plants and orange trees. My God, like what? 1704, I need a place that's now going to be built and established in the history of time so I can have a place for my orange trees. Like it's just absolutely wild. I'm fascinated by it all, the history of it all. I have one more old money family I want to tell you about. And I think it's actually important for us to know about this family for something very specific that's actually an old money tip. And then we're going to get into some of the more specifics about European old money women and what they do differently. So the last family I want to talk about is the House of Grimaldi. And I thought I knew that name, but I was actually thinking about the Princess of Genovia, which to me kind of feels like maybe that's what Princess Diaries was based off of. I was like, Grimaldi, that sounds familiar. But they're actually the ruling family of Monaco. So again, oh, maybe this is interesting. Like, I don't know what Prince William's last name is. Is it Kensington? No, it can't be Kensington. You guys are probably screaming at your phone right now being like, girl, it's whatever it is. But you can send me a DM and let me know what Prince William's last name is. But my point is Grimaldi, it rang a bell, but I couldn't place it. But as I mentioned, they're the ruling family of Monaco and have been since the 13th century. And the reason I didn't put that together is because we don't say the Prince of Monaco, whose name right now is Albert II, we don't call him Albert Grimaldi because you don't really use a last name with nobility. It's kind of like Madonna or Cher. Or Lady Gaga. Lady, that's a title. Gaga, House of. We get it. But the House of Grimaldi is the current reigning house of the Principality of Monaco. And they've been around since the 13th century. And they have just been super successful business people, a business family. The family itself, or the house, was founded. And that's crazy. The house was founded. What does that even mean? Like a coat of arms? I don't know. But it was founded in 1160 by Grimaldo Canella in Genoa and became the ruling house of Monaco when Francesco Grimaldi captured Monaco in 1297. So he claimed that. That's what I'm talking about, as first mover's advantage. If you're there and you're available when there's something to claim, you're going to fight for it. Now it's yours. And then over the course of hundreds of years from something you stole from somebody else, you became super wealthy. As I mentioned, the current head of state is Albert II. He's the Prince of Monaco. And his mom was Grace Kelly. So you probably know the name Grace Kelly from the fact that she was a super successful American actress in the 40s and 50s. And she actually married her husband, Prince Rainier III, in 1956. And they stayed married until her death in 1982. But what I thought was so interesting about this is depending on where you read, and again, as they say, history is written by the ones who won the battles, and they want to paint things in a good light, which comparatively to England, with Princess Diana and everything, it's interesting to compare the two. But there's a lot of documented, like I would say, like House of Grace Kelly type of stuff. Like, what is this page called? It's like gracekellyhistory.com or something like that. And oh, beyondgracekelly.com. And they talk a lot about the fact that there was movies made and articles written about how unhappy Princess Grace was in her marriage. there's a People article talking all about how Prince Rainier and Grace Kelly first met. And it's a pretty charming story, actually. She was there in Cannes to do some work with MGM, the studio that she worked for. And her and the prince were on the same train. And the actress from Gone with the Wind introduced them. And somebody thought that they should meet together. And it just so happened that Grace Kelly agreed, but she said, to be above board, I will only do it if there is a head of the studio with me to chaperone me. So she was very classy about it. And then she was getting ready in the morning to meet him at the Carlton Hotel, a very famous hotel in Cannes where I have yet to stay, but it's on my list. I've been there, but I haven't stayed there. It's just iconic, iconique. It's where everybody stays for the film festival. And that's where she was staying. So she washed her hair in the morning and then discovered that a labor strike had cut off all of the electricity to the city. So she had no hair dryer, no makeup lights, no iron. So she had to put her hair under like a big cloth or something to look presentable. And then she got in a fender bender. I mean, just like the story, it's like so meet cute, right? It's something that Jack Black in The Holiday would be like, this is how they met, and or that old guy in The Holiday, which, by the way, what a good movie. My point is, there's stories online of them meeting and falling in love and being so happy. And then there's other stories that she was deeply unhappy, was subjected to very invasive fertility tests before the monarchy would allow for her to marry Prince Rainier to make sure that she would be able to produce an heir. That's very common in this nobility conversation, right? And then there is a lot of articles written, and I guess movies produced, about how unhappy she was that she had worked so hard to be a successful actress. And then she had to give up her career to move to Monaco. And she gave up her friends and her family. And also that the people of Monaco didn't accept her at first because she was an American. She was an outsider. And it's hard to really know what the truth is with any of this. But at the end of the day, I mean, being a princess, if that's what you're into, we saw from Meghan Markle, wasn't from her, but for Grace Kelly, she was able to take on the pressures and stay married to her husband for the remainder of her life. And again, you know, she was Catholic. You never know about people's beliefs about divorce and if that's available to them and if she was happy or not. But the other thing that's mentioned is that Prince Rainier lived a very independent life and basically left Grace Kelly to her own devices. So I just find this all to be so interesting because that all the legacy, the lore, the Hollywood, the tie-in, the pop culture, like we're all fascinated by old money families. I am. I think you are if you're listening to this episode, and how they really stay in power and how they live and how they act. But just a quick aside, I think one of the reasons why Monaco is so interesting is because of the wealth in the country itself. So being within the House of Grimaldi is one thing because you are the ruling family of Monaco, but you're also the ruling family of the wealthiest nation in the world. Like just to give you a frame of reference, you know how they talk about the top 1%? Like to be in the top 1% in the United States of wealth, you need to have a net worth of $5.8 million. But because people in Monaco are so wealthy, if you want to be within the top 1% of wealth in Monaco, you need to have a net worth of nearly double that, $13 million. It's crazy. Monaco has the highest density of millionaires in the world, with more than 30% of its residents. By the way, there's only 38,000 people that live in this whole country, but 30% of them are millionaires. And one of the reasons why people are so drawn to Monaco is because it's a tax haven. So it attracts very wealthy individuals in big foreign countries. There's no income tax there. And if you establish your business, they have very low business taxes. Also, very interestingly, the country retains monopolies in areas like gambling. You've seen the Monte Carlo Hotel and Casino, tobacco, the postal service, the telephone network. It's very interesting. So overall, the average wealth of a person living in Monaco easily exceeds $10 million. So it's the top ranked city in the world on a wealth per capita basis. I have been to Monaco. It's very small. The streets are very windy and charming. It's up on a hill. I stayed at the JW Marriott in the weirdest room. It felt like it was Mickey Mouse Playhouse. It was like all weird colors and stuff. I think we just got a bad room, but the hotel was nice. But Monaco is very interesting because it's a lot of show and not a lot of go. Like, there's not a lot to do there unless you're literally at an F1 race or on a yacht or you're shopping. It's not like beaches, beach clubs, et cetera. The restaurants were fine. I actually ate at McDonald's there, so it was great, just FYI. But Monaco is so interesting because it's just so small. It's so close to everything else. You can so easily travel in and out, get to other countries, do your business. But a lot of people do try to move there because of, like I said, the tax haven status and the very low business tax requirements. So a lot of people, there's a lot of searches online, like, can I move to Monaco? And in order to do so, to apply to be a resident in Monaco, all you need to do there is deposit €500,000 into a bank. And then that money has to be held there by a Monaco bank for the entire time that you live there, and you can be a resident. So I think that's really interesting. And the other thing, another country to look out for that people talk about a lot, especially with European money, is Switzerland. So Switzerland is, similarly to Monaco, a tax haven. It's got very low household taxes and very low business taxes. They also have just a great economy and a great banking system. So the Swiss bank sector is super different than banking in many other places in the world because it has a strong commitment to, get this, banking secrecy. They are all about client confidentiality. Obviously, they used to be super lock and key, and they've had to evolve a little bit over time to balance privacy with, you know, working with authorities, so to speak, because before they were super confidential about everything having to do with banking, including where the money came from, who held the accounts. They weren't disclosing anything at all. And that's why it grew so strongly as a financial center in Europe. But now they've, like I said, they've evolved so that they can comply with standards of disclosing bank information if there is, I mean, number one, permission, but also in cases where there's criminal activity suspected or something weird going on. There is a bank called Credit Suisse, S-U-I-S-S-E, which I think is how you say it. And they had this huge leak that unmasked the fact that they were hoarding money or holding money from corrupt politicians, criminals, fraudulent people, bank robbers, like the whole thing. It was this centuries-old code of silence. And after this data leak, they were like, oh, it looks like some of our clients are involved in torture and drug trafficking and money laundering and corruption. And it just was a big wake-up call to everybody to say, maybe we should have these banks do a little bit more due diligence about where all this money is coming from. So, give you an example, this is something that strippers talk about all the time on TikTok. It's like when you take all of your ones to the bank, they're like, okay, what is your profession, right? And you're like, I'm a dancer and I work for tips. But if you try to walk into a bank with a briefcase and a duffel bag of $500,000, the bank isn't going to happily deposit that cash for you while you suck on one of those dum-dum lollipops that every bank has. And they're so disgusting, by the way. They're going to ask you some questions like, where did this money come from? And was it acquired legally or illegally? And are we making sure that this is getting reported on your taxes? So Switzerland before was super, super lock and key. And because of that, they have so many people that have moved there to take advantage of that. Get this. In 2022, they did a count of how many billionaires there were in Switzerland. And they had B, billionaires, 110 billionaires, which is one for every 80,000 people. And surprisingly, it's more than any other wealthy country, like, well, more than Saudi Arabia, more than Singapore, more than the UAE, like Geneva, Zurich, Lugano. You're going to get a ton of billionaires and millionaires there. And again, they love the low levels of financial risk, the high levels of privacy, the low taxes, the stable economy, high wages, and really, really high quality of life. So what are we to learn from Monaco and Switzerland? It's that taxes matter, baby. Taxes matter, baby. And I'm working on getting a tax expert on the show to talk to us about that coming up soon. We're kind of getting into, I mean, we're coming into the second year of Old Money Podcast. I can't believe that. We've really set the stage for the first year. And while we're going to go back and dive into some more if you are starting from more humble beginnings, what to do to set yourself up for success. But also we're going to get into some of those more advanced financial strategies like trusts, estates, how to, you know, work with your tax professionals and how to start businesses in the right way, all these things. What we're learning from European old money families is that the way to maintain your wealth is to pay low taxes. Now, there's obviously also a lot of political and ideological ramifications that come along with that question. So I'm still trying to figure out how to balance it all. You know, we do like to see people that have money pay their fair share. We do like to also make sure that people that earn that money and provide value to the world be compensated without having different rules made for them because they've been successful. So we're going to talk about it all. But today, that's for another day. Today, we're going to talk about European old money vibes. Because when we look at all of the old money vibes that we see, especially on Instagram, on Pinterest, it's giving caricature, right? It's giving J. Crew catalog. And a lot of it is just cosplay. Like, I have to say, this old money look that is trending a lot on Pinterest with the big bows and the pearls, that's Blair Waldorf. That's not necessarily the way that people who have generational wealth always dress. That's the way a very popular character on a very popular teen TV show dressed, and people associate her attitude and her family history with that look. So when I think about European old money vibes, or just European vibes in general that have nothing to do with money, here's what I've gleaned. I think there are four core categories of differences between Americans and Europeans. And by the way, if you're European, like Berta, who I know is listening to this, I would love your feedback. Like, let's have a conversation about this on social. We need to talk about it more because I'm not European. I'm American. So this is my observation and my thoughts about it, but I'd love to know what you all think. If you agree, if you think there's more nuance, less nuance, whatever. But when I'm in Europe, and I've been lucky to spend a good amount of time traveling in Europe throughout the course of my life, there are definitely some things that I pick up, and I'm an observer. I'm just watching, I'm listening, I'm seeing, and then I take that back and I'm synthesizing. And this is what I've synthesized. I really believe when we look at European old money vibes, there are four core differences between Euro and American. And those core differences are growing up, like how people were raised. It's about a life philosophy. It's about beauty. And it's about business. I'm fascinated by this. So again, if you think that there's more, tell me. But let me dive into each of these and tell you what I see in them. Like, first of all, in growing up, in raising your children, if you have a kid, somebody's probably tried to push on you that French book, I think it's called like Raising Bébé or Growing Up Bébé or something like that. I don't know. But it's a book about French parenting. And I just so happen, one of my very best friends who has two beautiful girls that I'm obsessed with, one of whom is my goddaughter. Both of them are my goddaughters. I'm obsessed with these girls. They are little French babies, my best friend's French. Her mom was raised in Paris. My friend was raised all over the world, really, but she went to boarding school when she was young. She's traveled all over the world. She's very well-read, well-educated. She's polite. She's lovely. And she raises her children in a very French way. And the summary of that book essentially is live your life as an adult and have your children meld into your life, not you into theirs. So I think the point is that a lot of American families change their whole life and routine and kind of, I don't want to say play down to, but they adjust their life to the child versus the child adjusting the life to the parents. And a good example of that is the fact that we have things like the Nickelodeon Hotel. Yeah, it's similar to Disneyland, but Disneyland has a bit of elegance in lore and storytelling around it, where Nickelodeon as a brand is loud, chaotic, it's slime, it's primary colors. It's not a place that I would have fun. And therefore, I won't be spending my time or money there. But I know that my child would have fun at a beach, or my future child anyway, at a beach, or like I did growing up. I went everywhere with where my parents went. One of my mom's favorite stories to tell me is that she used to take me to the Japanese Tea Garden in, not Central Park, in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And as a toddler, I would sit there and sip my tea and eat my cookies and be behaved. And I was really raised in a very adult-centric world. And I think that's the philosophy of this French parenting book as well. You have your children eat with a fork and a knife. They sit at the table. They have adult conversations. They still have a childhood. It's not super intense, but you're not melding your whole life to fit in with your children's interest. You are balancing play and enrichment with things that are a little bit more adult. And with that being said, I think just the fact of European families living in Europe, just think about how much more easy it is to, if you have means, explore your neighboring countries and all of these rich histories and cultures that the equivalent would be, you know, flying from California to Texas. And yeah, you can see those are very different cultures. But if you fly from UK, from London to Paris, and then you can immerse your child in French culture or Italian culture, or Swiss culture, or German culture, just by sheer proximity, you have so many more cultural enrichment opportunities for your children to be exposed to. In addition to that, what you see is a lot of people who immigrate throughout the EU. And so wouldn't it be uncommon for you to have Spanish friends, Italian friends, French friends, German friends, Belgian friends, whatever it might be, because it's just like having friends in Arizona, Nevada, and you know, Washington or Oregon if you live in California. It's the same type of idea, right? In addition to that, because you are raised in close proximity to so many people who speak different languages, language is such an emphasis in childhood in Europe. So when you have people that are raised in Europe or in Connecticut, like Countess Luann, who was a nurse and then claims to, you know, also be nobility thanks to the man that she married, Countess Luann speaks Italian and French, exala francais, remember? And I'm pretty sure she speaks Italian. Dorit is another example of that with her Buca di Beppo themed Capri groom, whatever it was. Language, there's just such a more emphasis. And I only know English. I've taken Spanish. My mother speaks Spanish as her first language, but I do not speak it confidently. I can understand it well, but I wish and just, I wish so badly that I had more of a mastery of other languages. It's something when I see a child who can speak two languages, I'm like, you are a brilliant scientist. I don't know how you do it. But it's just the way that you're raised there. It's just more exposure to culture, to language, to different types of people. And I think this also, when you're growing up, it just gives you context to the world. We live in a pretty homogeneous society here in the States. If you live in Florida, you kind of get Florida. If you live in Texas, you get Texas. If you live in the Midwest or even New York or San Francisco, your space, your area is pretty homogeneous. And even if you go outside of the immediate area, we're still mostly English-speaking Americans, but I see the difference. And I'm not saying there's not diversity in the U.S. There is a ton of beautiful diversity here. But I think what's different about the United States is that when people come to the United States, they're expected to meet the American standard or to assimilate into the American way of life. I know that's not true always, but I think kind of generally speaking, that could be a conclusion. Whereas you have many different, very, very distinct types of cultures within different countries in Europe versus, you know, what's the difference in the culture between Colorado and Wyoming or Montana and Idaho? You know what I'm saying? So I find that to be really interesting to be raised with so much context about different types of cultures and then also just exposure to more things. You're in art, you're in culture like music, and there's more history there. I think being raised in a European city, town, or country would be really interesting just in the roots that you have there and the connectedness to where you're from. And my last thought on just how you grow up in the EU in comparison to the US is with education. I think there's a lot more different types of education, whether it's kind of like that Montessori style or forest school. As you go up into higher education, you get into boarding schools, which there are in the US as well. But I think they're maybe a little bit less bizarre in the EU, where there's a real focus on excellence in education. And also, did you know that most European countries heavily subsidize higher education in university setting. In France, for example, anything is incredibly subsidized by the French government. So, of course, there's the tax conversation again, like who pays for that? But they don't have this college university tuition inflation issue that we have in the US. Even in Germany, all public higher education is free, even the highest ranked universities in the country. So there's just a difference there about what your opportunities are, because so many people in the US, I know, forego going to university because they can't afford it. They can't even afford the application fees. And what would your life be like if instead of thinking you're going to survive through high school, get a GED and then figure it out from there? I mean, it's very different than an opportunity in the EU where you can get to higher education and have a path for your future, regardless of the cost in some countries. So the second category that really dovetails nicely into that is what I believe to be this philosophy that Europeans have that Americans do not. And that's based on what we all value. Now, I'm painting with a very broad brush, but typically speaking, I think that you would say that Americans really value the American dream, owning a home, having 2 cars, 2.5 kids, the white picket fence. I think they really value status and working hard and showcasing how successful we've been. I think we also, especially for the younger generation, we value, you know, status in the way that I want to say, like going to the Vegas club, so to speak. Not that there aren't clubs, better clubs than there will ever be in Europe than the US. But my point is just the philosophy of life in Europe is different in the way that I feel Europeans enjoy life. The American way is just focused on productivity, and the European way is focused on quality of life. I mean, we talk about the time off that you get as an employee or a worker in Europe, all of August off, you get pretty much unlimited PTO, but it's not where your manager is hating you for taking the PTO. It's about everybody does it, so it's normalized. And unfortunately, even though companies might have that in place in the US, it just doesn't work because we're not set up to support it. In the US, we are eating our lunches at our desk, not taking breaks, where in Europe, people are taking, you know, a leisurely lunch outside with a glass of wine to enjoy their colleagues for a break or having a siesta in the afternoon. There's a difference in, we'll get into this in the business conversation, but there's just a difference in the essence where you're more connected to the rhythms of life, the food, the seasonality. I feel like it's actually a lot more relaxed in general from a nervous system type of a conversation. Of course, every person is different, but the philosophy values connection and food and pleasure, love over, you know, consumption and this productivity and this hustle that we see so much of in the US. And we see it really idealized in the US, which is so interesting. In addition to that, the philosophy about being around other people and manners and etiquette, I find to be really interesting. The first day that we were in Tuscany on our trip, Justin and I sat down to this beautiful, beautiful lunch out in the countryside where there was a fresh garden, where they picked everything from the garden for my salad. And there was 2 couples sitting adjacent to us. 2 different couples, they were clearly friends that didn't spend a lot of time together because they were catching up. But there was 1 woman, 3 of them were European, 1 woman was American. We knew this because she would not shut up. She was so loud and she would not stop name dropping. I know that she lives in Montecito. She also has a house in New York. I know that she knows senators. She was dropping all of these different political names and complaining about how people were, how she was turned away at a party, and then the owner of the restaurant approached her, apologized profusely. She wouldn't shut up, and she was making sure that she was dominating the whole conversation. Now, this is not just an American thing. This is any type of culture thing, but I just was thinking, like, that is so nouveau riche, that is so loud, and that's so not the essence of what I imagine with Europeans. I imagine leaning back, enjoying the sunshine, having a glass of wine and a cigarette, and listening and being polite and cognizant of how you show up in the group versus that pretty typical American barking at everyone else. And you could tell at one point her husband had left the table and her girlfriend had left the table. These people were probably in their 60s or 70s. And it was just her and the other husband. And she did not let him get a word in edgewise. Justin and I were on the edge of our seats eavesdropping and loving the drama. But my point is that that energy, that very American need to control and be loud and be seen, you don't want to be more loud. You want to be more smart, more connected. People don't remember what you said. They remember how you made them feel. So I thought that was an interesting observation about politeness, etiquette, presentation, all of that type of thing. But speaking of presentation, I saw this so perfectly summed up on TikTok and I had to share it with you all. I wish I remembered the creator, but I went back in my saves and my likes and I could not find it. I guess I didn't save it or like it, which shame on me because it was good content. But the point of the content, and this is in relation to beauty, which I think is like the third big category of old money. Beauty, especially in Europe, is only about hygiene. That means a fresh haircut, clean skin, clean nails, less is more. We're not saying that the French women don't wear red lipstick. We're not saying they don't get their hair done. What we're saying is that the American fascination with beauty is enhancement, big lips, no movement in your forehead, big boobs, big hips, super tight skin, super long hair, hair extensions, eyelash extensions, nail extensions. You don't see that in Europe at all. French beauty is natural. I'm thinking of European beauty. It's natural. It's hygiene. It's cleanliness. It's neatness. And it's so much less fake. So when we think about just the most beautiful women, old money style, they're just the most natural women. Like we don't see, think about Kate Middleton or Princess B, or I don't even know who else to reference. Even Nikki Hilton Rothschild, she doesn't have that very overdone look like you see on a lot of the more popular. I mean, one of the biggest new money families in the US, Kardashians, they're the complete opposite of that, right? So I'm not saying one is bad or one is better than the other. I know which path I'm going down, but I also still have my eyelash extensions. Like it's fine. There's a blend of both, right? But that whole concept of beauty is just hygiene, I think that's perfectly summed up of the differences between US and European beauty standards, especially when we look at old money version. And then the last thing that I think is really important, and I wanted to make this a practical tip as well, because we do a lot of business with people all over the world. And what's really interesting is the way that the Europeans and the Americans kind of work together. And we've also worked with a lot of Latin American companies, and I would say they're more European as well. Whereas the US is very direct. We're like, here's the meeting, here's the agenda, here's the action items. And European communication is much more nuanced, where the focus is really on building great relationships that are sustained over time. In the US, like I'm even training my team, like how to have an efficient and brief email, where in Europe, it's okay to be more detailed and more, I don't know, like softer in the language. It's more formal even. In the US, it's more informal. But when we talk about the types of relationships that I've personally experienced, it's normal to have a catch-up conversation on your call for 15 minutes or more before you even get into work. I mean, it's all about building relationships. When we think about that, think about the types of relationships that endure in countries where they've been around for 700 years and the people that are wealthy there have been wealthy for 700 years. It's all about relationships. And in the US, we really think a lot about learning how to be assertive and confident, not bitchy, but confident, right? Like being a girl boss and being direct and not using exclamation points, right? It's more fast-paced. It's more results-oriented. It's definitely known, the US, for being entrepreneurial and innovative, where Europeans are more concerned about, you know, tradition and relationships, and they're typically more risk adverse, which is interesting from an investing standpoint. And it's more, I would say, like long-term. It's more long-term thinking, long-term history. There's a lot of emphasis on establishment there because they have the length of history to lean on. So, you know, in the US, when you're making a meeting with somebody who's in your same field or in your same area, it's not uncommon to have a 30-minute meeting. But in Europe, you might be out to lunch or out to dinner and having a meeting that starts with wine and meanders, and maybe you get to your agenda and maybe you don't. So that's been a big learning experience for me of working with different cultures. And I know, like, my friend Susanna, who I talked about on the last episode, she studied international business. She got her master's in Europe and was so in tune with all the nuances of all the different cultures. And I think it's just so fascinating. And I think the more we know about that, the better off we'll be in building our old money fortunes, our generational wealth, whether we do it locally or we do it globally. So that's my take on my European adventure and European old money in comparison to the US. And again, I'm not European. So if you are and you have more to add to this conversation, I would love to hear from you. Please send me a DM. You know where to find me, Old Money Podcast on Instagram. Or if you want to be anonymous, go to the website, oldmoneypodcast.com. I love you guys so much. We're coming up on the 1-year anniversary of Old Money. I'm so appreciative of you all for being here. Thank you so much for your support, for listening to this episode, and I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. Feeling rich? I hope so. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Old Money. If you have questions you want answered, email me at oldmoneypodcast@gmail.com or hit us up on social. We are at Old Money Podcast, and I am at your service. If this episode spoke to you, inspired you, helped you, if you took a single note, it would mean the world to me if you could please just take a minute to rate and review the podcast. And if you're not doing so already, subscribe. And if you have friends who like getting rich, please share this episode with them, even if it's just on your Instagram story. And I'd love you more than Jeff Bezos loves Amazon Prime. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you on the next episode. Remember, I'm not your lawyer, I'm not your tax professional, and I'm not your financial advisor. The content presented in this podcast is intended to entertain, educate, inspire, and support listeners in their personal and professional development and does not constitute business, financial, or legal advice. In addition to that, this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services.